I did want to say just a couple things about Jesus, the teacher, just because the form in which Jesus teaches ends up being important to the interpretation of what Jesus teaches. In other words, form relates directly to content. And so by that, what I mean is that Jesus really is a rabbi. He's referred to as teacher 40 times in the Gospels, and he uses modes of communication that were very common among the rabbis of his day. And so where they would tend to speak in more word pictures, evocative, kind of non-linear language. And so what I have on your handout is a summary of the major ways that Jesus taught, the way that he kind of conveys his ideas. And I basically stole it, or summarized it, from Robert Stein's The Method and Message of Jesus' Teaching. You can get that at the Study Center. It's a really, I think, valuable book. But he, you know, when you read through, a lot of people turn the wrong way reading through the Gospels because they read stuff that Jesus says and they're like, whoa, you gotta be kidding. You know, because he uses fit ways of communicating that don't mean to us necessarily what it meant to them. So, for example, he uses hyperbole, like all the time. That's a joke. You know, you can't be my disciple unless you hate your parents. Well, that seems really extreme. Well, it is extreme, but the point is not that you should hate your parents. It's just that following me is just so important that there's not even a close second. That's really what he's saying. Because he also tells them, of course, to honor your father and mother. There's a framework, there's an understanding. But he uses these strong, memorable exaggerations just to alert you as the reader. He uses pun, which are usually lost on us as English readers because the puns are in Aramaic. He uses simile and metaphor, in other words, comparisons, quite a bit. The quality of one thing relates to the quality of another. Be shrewd as serpents, innocent as doves. You know, things like that. Metaphor is really common. The leaven of the Pharisees, you know, stuff like that. And the parables, of course, are basically metaphors. Proverbs are like wise, memorable adages. Where your treasure is, there lies your heart also. Boy, everyone just remembers stuff like that. And, of course, in a culture where to buy a scroll of Scripture would have been prohibitively expensive. Only the very wealthy would have had their own scroll of anything, or even a set of Scriptures put on metal or on hide. Those things did exist, but they existed for the wealthy. And the vast majority of people that are sitting under Jesus' teaching can't afford things like that. So Jesus is speaking with these pithy one-liners. He's saying things that summarize what he is saying in a way that is memorable to them. And that is the important part of why he uses this kind of stuff. A fortiori, if this, how much more that? If your fathers gave you bread to eat, well, how much more your Father in heaven? He uses that kind of language. Sarcasm is used quite a bit. Jesus, as it turns out, is very sarcastic, and which I like that. I'm glad for that. It's a model for sarcastic people like me. but there's some examples of it on your outline that you can look up. He uses rhetorical questions very effectively. One of the center point almost of the Gospels, geographically and thematically, is right before the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus asks this question, you know, who do the multitudes say that I am? And the disciples, they all have different takes on who they hear that people think Jesus is. And then he says, but who do you say that I am? Boy, that is a big question. And it just, you know, it blows the disciples' hair back, and the whole trajectory of the Gospels changed with Peter's affirmation, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And so questions are a way of getting at things. They make you think, and they make you draw conclusions. All these figures of speech are there to make you ponder, to make you reflect, to chew on this thing for a while. Parallelism is used. We'll see that in the Sermon on the Mount next week. Parables, yeah, Jesus also used a lot of parables, you're aware of that. And in relation to these figures of speech, and especially parables, when Jesus uses these common descriptive forms of communication, typically there's a single general point being made. And the context becomes important to understand what that point is. And sometimes the gospel writer will in fact tell us what that point is before giving like a parable or something along those lines. So for instance, in Luke 18, you have the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, which begins in verse 9 where Matthew says that Jesus told them a parable of those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. And then he gives the story of the Pharisee and the publican and makes the point at the end that it's the publican, the tax gatherer, who went home to his home justified and not the tax gatherer. So parables, you know, may be colorful and detailed as a story, but they really make a single point almost always. So Jesus is a rabbi, Jesus is a prophet, and he's identified as such in your outline. Mark 14:65, Luke 7:16, Matthew 21:11 and 46, where he's acknowledged to be and identified as a prophet. And he does things that prophets do. There are signs and miracles that Jesus performs that in your reading of the prophets in the Old Testament, this is exactly what you've come to see. And so in Luke 19, for instance, in verses 45 to 48, as Jesus cleanses the temple and kind of, you know, goes postal on the scene in there, that is an action of prophetic significance. It's cleansing the temple in much the same idea carrying with this as Jeremiah chapter 7, the famous temple sermon that Jeremiah gives. It evokes those images. His message is inspired by the Holy Spirit, like all the prophets, the Spirit of God is with them. There's a divine calling and a divine message that Jesus has. And so Matthew 12, verse 18, cites Isaiah 42, verses 1 to 4, that Jesus is, in fact, the servant of the Lord who has come in his name to deliver his message to his people. The prophets are rejected, as we talked about a few weeks ago, and like the prophets, Jesus too is rejected. And so in Luke 13, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and those who are sent to her? How often I've wanted to gather you under my wing like a hen does his chicks, but you would not, you know, and just that rejection of the people toward Jesus is really reminiscent of the prophets. Then too, Jesus's unique authority beyond the prophets, beyond Moses. Like I said earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus compares his own authority to that of Moses. You have heard it said, but I say to you. Or the testimony of John the Baptist, that Jesus is greater than he as the last of the prophets, or the ultimate statement of authority in Matthew or in John chapters 8 and 10, where Jesus uses the I am formula. Remember that from all the way back in Exodus 3, who are you? You know, I am sent you. Exodus 3 and 4 and 6. And so Jesus is claiming to be Yahweh. I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection, and so forth. And that message was not lost on Jesus' critics who picked up stones to throw at him, lest we understand in context or forget in context. They understood exactly what Jesus was saying. And then, of course, very importantly, Jesus teaches through action, the so-called parabolic acts of Christ. So there are signs that he performs, and again, where he performs these things, when he performs them, for whom Jesus performs miracles, very important. The when question, you know, it's so often Jesus must have thought that the Sabbath was just set aside specifically for the purpose of healing. And because the majority of the healings that Jesus performs are on the Sabbath, which immediately enters Jesus into controversy, because is healing a work? Because you know you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. We're thinking about buying a new stove. I bet that's interesting to you. What's particularly interesting is that they sell stoves now with, what's it called, a Sabbath clock? Sabbath mode. So that every seventh day, the thing will actually function without anyone touching it. That's hilarious. Pharisaism is not dead. Don't want to be working, don't want to, you got to eat, but you don't want to cook, because that would just be like, you know, wrong. When Jesus heals is important. Who Jesus heals, very important. Jesus has this hankering for the losers, the outcasts, the guilty, the unclean, the leper, the prostitute, you know, all of these people. Who Jesus performs miracles on, very important. He's teaching a lesson. And, of course, where these things happen also is important, which we'll get to in just a second. So the actions of Jesus advance his teaching against the background of contemporary Judaism. That's very important. We'll talk about that at length when we get to the whole issue of historic context. Jesus is a controversialist at the bottom, at the end of the day. His teachings were designed to inflame opposition to God and, on the other hand, to do dramatically demonstrate God's grace, God's love, God's mercy. And so, there's that. Now, what I want to do, before we get into kind of a presentation of structure, we've already looked at narrative structure before, so I thought we would just look at some examples in the Gospels of narrative structure and then get into some of the principles of it, so that, because I think they're going to be familiar to you having gone through this already with Old Testament narrative. Well, why don't you turn with me then to Matthew 15. And we'll just give the illustration before we give the explanation of the principles of structure. Here's the case of the Syrophoenician woman. And I want to just walk through a couple of these structure steps. In Matthew 15, it's 21 through 28 is where the story is. And the context, as it turns out, is actually pretty important, namely that Jesus has just confronted the Pharisees with a discussion over ritual defilement. And they've had this conversation about, what is it that defiles a man? Is it what you take in, or was it, or what it comes out? And so he really is harshly putting down the Pharisaic, adding on to the law all these stipulations about cleanliness that distance themselves from the heart of the law, which is God's love. Then following the narrative, on the other end of it, is the feeding of the 4,000. A narrative directed both to the pagan woman in this pagan setting, which we'll see in a minute, and to the disciples. And so, basically, we find the story of the Syrophoenician woman in the framework of Jesus' very substantial, combative engagement with the religious establishment. So with that context in view, why don't we go ahead and read the thing, and then we'll break it down into the scenes and just kind of show how the structure orients itself to what the main point is and how it's supported. So we begin in verse 21. Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And a Canaanite woman from the region came out and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." But he did not answer her a word, and his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us." But he answered and he said to them, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came, verse 25, and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and he said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table." Then Jesus said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. And so here, this is an interesting story. I think it breaks down pretty easily into three scenes based upon the people that Jesus is addressing. The first being the woman. This is verses 21 and 22. And what do we pick up here? Who is this woman? Who is she? She's a Canaanite woman. She is in the region of Tyre and Sidon. Where is that? That's not in Israel, is it? That's north. So he's gone outside of the borders of Israel into pagan territory. So who is it? It's a Canaanite woman. Canaanites. Really unclean group. Woman. In the presence of a rabbi? Really? Outside of the domain of Israel. And when does this happen? What does it tell us? Read carefully. And the answer is, it doesn't. Okay. That's all right. We just know that it happens after they went and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. We don't know exactly when it was. We don't know what day of the week it was. But what we want to note here, just in the interaction between the woman and Jesus, is that, see, Jesus leaves Israel after engaging Jerusalem's religious elite over the nature of ritual cleanliness. And he retreats to this pagan land. And the Canaanite woman, unlike either the disciples or the religious authorities, this woman recognizes Jesus' true identity as the Son of David. Isn't that interesting? Son of David, she says in verse 22. And if you look at Matthew 9:27 and 12:23, the other references to Jesus, the Son of David, there's something ironic, namely, which is that in all cases, they come from unclean lips. Now, why is that ironic? Why is that significant? A Canaanite woman in a pagan country recognizes that Jesus is the Son of David. Only people who are unclean, in fact, in Matthew's gospel, have recognized Jesus as the Son of David. What does it tell us? It's one of these reversals that you see all over the gospel. The people who should get it don't. The people who shouldn't get it do. The people who you think are blessed are cursed. The people that you think are cursed are blessed. All of this completely unexpected thing going on, and it is absolutely a direct confrontation with the religious establishment. They are guilty. The proof of their guilt is that even this woman, who is as unclean can be, unlike them, recognizes Jesus' own true identity. So that's a remarkable place for this narrative to begin. And then the second piece, then, is when Jesus then begins to interact with the disciples in verses 23 and 24, which will set up the action that Jesus actually performs. Jesus is silent with this woman. He does not reply to her directly, but he does reply to his disciples' desire to send this woman away, and his response is significant. He says, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." Okay, I am the Messiah of the Jewish people. Well, okay, what is the significance of that statement? Well, for one, it fits on one level the description of Messiah as it's given to us in the Old Testament, namely that God's Messiah is the Messiah to the Jewish people. So in that sense, it's true. But clearly, Jesus is playing to his disciples' belief, which was common among all the Jewish people of this day, that the Messiah is uniquely the possession of the Jewish people. And so I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Is that really true? Is that what Jesus really thinks? Or is he parroting their view? Which would it be, and how would you know? Well, you would know based upon the action of the next scene, right? What does he do? And so this interaction really brings the disciples to this place of thinking, oh, who is this guy Jesus? What does it mean that he is the son of David? And so the third scene kind of resolves the thing as he interacts with this woman, which is such a remarkable exchange. Think about this. Here he is. It's not good, Jesus says, to throw the children's bread to the dogs, the Gentiles, the goyim, you know, referred to as dogs. And so he's telling this woman what? That you're a dog? Is that what he literally means? No. It's a figure of speech. Again, this is Jesus using rabbinical communication. He's creating a picture for her. She knows that this is exactly how Jewish religious people feel about Canaanite people and Canaanite women in particular. They even called them dogs. But Jesus is not meaning this in that same condescending and literal sense. Instead, what he's trying to do is evoke something from her where she then, and she, because she takes the bait. That was also a figure of speech. She said, "Yes, Lord." She doesn't say, "Oh, I resent that." Because why? Because she's desperate for one thing, and for another, she knows that he's not being deliberately offensive. "Yes, Lord, but even dogs feed on the crumbs which fall on their master's table." What is she doing here? She's not disagreeing with him. She's just saying, "I don't deserve, but I want to be included." See that? I don't deserve. I'll take that. I am not a member of the family around the table. I am a Canaanite. I get that. And I accept it. But I still want to appeal to you, son of David, king of Israel, the Messiah, to participate in those blessings. And, you know, of course, we've been reading the Old Testament long enough to know how Jesus would respond to this, don't we? We know that the blessings of the Messiah when he comes are going to be global in their reach. And so, of course, Jesus is going to be able to respond to this woman. But he does it in a way that draws her faith out. Not looking at Jesus as a Coke machine to push the button and get what she wants, but to appeal to him. And so that's what happens, and Jesus responds seeing that faith and grants her request. So those are the three scenes that make up the story. And in terms of the structure then, the context is a challenge preceding this to the internal rather than external meaning of cleanliness. Then there are three points made in each of the scenes that make up the story. The first is based on irony. It's the identification of the unclean woman that Jesus is the son of David. And that just challenges this superiority that are driving the religious. The second is Jesus' point that the Messiah's mission centers on the lost of Israel. And the third point from the third scene is that the woman is basically pleading theologically for inclusion in the blessings of God to Israel. So the main point then comes at the end when Jesus himself pulls it together, where God honors the greatness of this woman's faith, both her persistence and the content of her faith, that she offers herself as a strong antithesis to the rabbi's tradition-based religion centering on purity and defilement. So, by understanding the context, and we see that here's a counterpoint in Jesus' argument against the religious, that all of the features of this story speak clearly to what he's already told them about this whole issue of cleanliness. So, in laying out structure, then you just want to identify, okay, what's this story coming to? What's the climactic point? What's the resolution to the tension or whatever? What is the main point? And then how do each of the scenes then kind of support or illustrate what that main point is? And it will be, I think, pretty easy as we get into these things for us to see the structure of it. Let's take a look at the preceding narrative in Matthew 15, verses 1 to 20. This is the one that sets this up. And I'll just briefly walk us through that. It says in verse 1, "Then some Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, 'Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they did not wash their hands when they ate bread.' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Well, why do you yourselves transgress the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition?'" So you have tradition against the behavior of the disciples. God said, "Honor your father and your mother. Well, he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death." Wow, radical. "But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, 'Whatever I have that would help you has been given to God,'" so-called Korban, "he is not to honor his father or mother. And by this, you invalidate the word of God for the sake of your own tradition, you hypocrites. Rightly did Isaiah prophesy against you in Isaiah 29. 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men.'" And after that, Jesus called the crowd to him, and he said, "Hear and understand, it is not what enters into the mouth that defiles the man, but what proceeds out of the mouth, this is what defiles the man." Then the disciples came to him and said, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this statement?" Duh. But Jesus answered, and he said, "Every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant will be uprooted. Let them alone, for they are blind guides of the blind, and if the blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into the pit. So Jesus is the conciliatory diplomat that he is. Okay, so that's a cool interaction. And again, the context, significant, the preceding narrative piece is Jesus walking on the water and Peter's faith in him, and because of his unique authority. The one that follows is the one we just looked at, the Syrophoenician woman, who is unclean but clean inside, unlike these Pharisees. She, in other words, is living out verse 11. It is not what enters into the mouth that defiles a man, but what proceeds out of the mouth. That's what defiles him. So the teaching is really broken down into who is Jesus talking to. And the first section, he's talking to the Pharisees and scribes. That's verse 1 through verse 9. Then in verses 10 and 11, he's talking to the crowd. And in verses 12 to 14, he's talking to his disciples. You see how that is? So in that way, the whole thing breaks down fairly easily. And we can just see that here's the structure of this narrative piece. Now, in terms of the main and supporting points, again, I think that this thing is pretty easily broken down. There's an introductory statement, which is verse 2, and it's a question. The Pharisees ask, why do your disciples violate the traditions by eating with ritually unwashed hands? Okay, so that's a question. I mean, they just can't believe Jesus is letting them, you know, eat without washing their hands in the ritual way and so forth. Then there, each of the three scenes are three audiences and three responses to that question, with a very deliberate conclusion being given after he interacts with Peter in verses 15 to 19, where he says, "These are the things which defile the man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the man." So that is a direct answer to a specific question. Do you see that? So the whole narrative is just structured around question, boom, scene one, boom, scene two, boom, scene three, and conclusion at the end. And so the first scene, in addressing the Pharisees, Jesus points out that their tradition, here's why it doesn't matter that they wash their hands according to tradition, it's because the tradition itself violates the law. And the example that he gave was this business of taking money that should be given to your parents to care for them in their old age, to honor thy father and thy mother, and dedicating it to the temple, which basically means that you can't use it for any other purpose except your own, and your parents are not entitled to that money. And so as a result, they're using this loophole to live selfishly and not care for their own parents. And that's not in the Old Testament law. That's just their own tradition. And Jesus says, your tradition directly contradicts the teaching of the law. And so the advocates of tradition, therefore, are simply hypocrites involved in the vain worship that Isaiah 29, verse 13 told us about. So that is the in-your-face smackdown to the religious establishment. Then when he addresses the multitudes, he's just very clear. Defilement is the result of what comes out of a person, not what goes into him. In other words, the whole ceremonial thing really doesn't matter at all. And then third, as he's now talking to his disciples who are kind of reeling in this conversation, knowing that he's just really ticked off some important people, Jesus responds with the parable of the uprooted plant and the blind guides. The Pharisees believed themselves to be guides to the blind, and they're teaching the guide to the perplexed. And Jesus is just putting that right in their face and saying, you know, it's the blind leading the blind. Bad news. And the conclusion then that it's the heart not unwashed hands that defile the man. So that is how that works. That's just fairly simple structure. And in all of the gospel narrative sections that we look at, they're just going to break out fairly easily. I think this is easier work than the Old Testament narratives that we studied. They're shorter, they're grouped thematically, and I just think that you're going to find yourself, not just because you're familiar with the Gospels, but because of the literature itself, more able to work your way through that. Now, let me close by having illustrated structural study to remind you of the primary principles, the things that we look for to identify or to find structure. And the first, again, just like we did with Old Testament narrative, we look for summary statements, conclusions, introductory statements given by the author first. And so the author will intrude himself, for example, in John 1:19, John, the writer, says that this is John's testimony when asked about Jesus. And so, you know, when the author stands out and makes this point by introducing or by setting up a teaching or a narrative piece, he really is alerting you as the reader to what the real point of this thing is. Or in John 2, verse 11, this is the beginning of signs. John says that the disciples believed in him. And then in verse 22, it's after he resurrected that they remembered that he had done this and said this, and they believed in him. And so here John is bringing us to this place where now Jesus with his disciples is through the signs that he performs, is cultivating belief. So the author intruding himself, explaining something, that's really a strong indication of what the point of the thing is. Conclusions that are put in the mouth of one of the characters, really significant. Matthew 12:12, for instance, which is, so then, Jesus says, that language, so then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. That sounds like a conclusion to me, and indeed it is. Or some moment of realization that comes in the mouth of a character. In Matthew 8, verse 27, this is Peter can't believe that that Jesus has stilled the storm at sea and asks and says rhetorically, "What kind of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So just that strong sense of conclusion or statement of conclusion tells us that's really what the point of this thing is. When imperatives are used, that is almost always the main point, and the descriptive material, the indicatives, supply support for why that imperative should be obeyed. "Pray like this," Jesus says to his disciples, before the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6, verse 9, or in John 3, verse 7, after all this explanation to Nicodemus, he simply says to him, "Dude, you must be born again." And so that's the main point. Repetition of a key term or a concept. We've already seen that in Matthew 8 and 9, this appeal to authority is really the main point in each of these narratives: Jesus' authority over the spirit world, over sin, over nature, over sickness, and so forth. In Luke 15, the parable of the things lost. So repetition strings together sets of teachings or narrative pieces, and when we see those repetitions, we know that we've kind of got what the main point of the deal is. Context can often be very important. The controversies that Jesus is willing to enter into. Who then can be saved? The disciples ask in Luke 18:26. And Jesus has to answer them, "The things impossible for men are possible for God." And so the context of the question being asked or a dilemma being posed is common. Connective words, thus, therefore, so, consequently, for this reason. Well, you just know how that works. Figures of speech, when they're used, so often they point us in the direction of what the main point is. When Jesus uses irony in Matthew 8:22, he says, "Let the dead bury the dead." That's the main point of his thing. He's trying to get people to understand that following him is way more important than anything else. There's parallelism used in Matthew 9, verses 12 and 13, where he contrasts through parallelism in poetry the healthy and the sick with the righteous and the sinners. I came, he says, as a physician to heal the sick, to save the sinners. And so that parallelism gets us to what the point is. Exaggeration or comparisons, a fortiori, how much more valuable are you than this rock or whatever. And then this expression that all the Gospels use, truly, or truly, truly I say to you, or I tell you truly, or whatever it is. Usually when that formula is given, boom, what follows after that's the main point that he's trying to get at. So those, again, these are just some tips just to have in your mind as you're reading through. Look for repetitions, look for what the context is, look for connective words, how are figures of speech used. And then the supporting points, the how and why questions, really. Really are oriented toward what is the basis for the main point? What is the evidence for the main point? What might be an illustration of the main point? And for support, the gospel writers are going to use Old Testament citations frequently. The basis for Jesus declaring this or calling for people to do that is rooted in not in the Old Testament text. It's something that is being fulfilled or something that is rooted in the true understanding of the Old Testament. Miracles as signs offer support for something that Jesus is teaching, that maybe his authority or his messianic identity or whatever. And then, of course, to connective words like because, for, since, stuff like that. These all point to reasons being given in support of a main point.